Previously on Beta.
How would you describe your music?
Well, I guess we're kind of competent.
How come we doing this?
Well, why not?
Well, they said it couldn't be done.
Well, that's the reason, son.
That's good with Fred. We're clear.
They dubbed these acid tests.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author Joe Hill talks about what it's like to collaborate with his father, Stephen King.
And the rocket blasts off after the Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote is hanging on top, barely clinging on for dear life. I've written with my dad on two short stories, and both times I felt like Wile E. Coyote hanging onto the rocket.
Also, author Casey Ray tells how legendary beat writer William S. Burroughs altered the course of rock and roll history.
Cobain was absolutely obsessed with Burroughs to the extent that he tried to get Burroughs to appear in the video for Heart-Shaped Box, which was a song from In Utero, Nirvana's final studio album.
But first, Carrie Brownstein. You may recognize her from the comedy show Portlandia. She's also one of the founding members of the band Slater Kinney. When the trio of two guitarists and a drummer formed in the mid-90s, they were a powerhouse from the start. They would eventually become one of the most influential bands from that era. Slater Kinney has evolved since the 90s and just released their ninth studio album, The Center Won't Hold. It still features Carrie's fierce guitar riffs, Corin Tucker's commanding vocals, and Janet Weiss's signature drumming. While the album contains Slater Kinney's essential ingredients, it was produced by musician Annie Clark, better known as St. Vincent. Clark added a new industrial and electronic sound to the band. But that's not all that's changed. Just after the record's release, Weiss left the group after 20 years as their drummer. Beta's Maureen McCollum caught up with Carrie Brownstein. They talked about life after Janet and the band's musical evolution.
We've been a band for 25 years. Corin Tucker and I started this band way back in 1994 when we were still in college in Olympia, Washington. And when you start out, I think very few musicians imagine themselves 1, 5, 10 years down the road, let alone, you know, over two decades. I think a goal with every record, every transition has been to challenge ourselves to do something different, to defy expectations. And then I think eventually we just reached a place where, you know, we just want to set the bar higher for ourselves and to, you know, have a sense of freedom. And when you finally get to making your ninth studio album, which we just did, it really felt like, what else do we have to prove? Our goal is to make music that doesn't sound like the last thing we did, and to still enjoy it, to come at it with a sense of gratitude, and always to do it with a sense of integrity and passion and to need it, I think, as much as the fans do, because, you know, we understand that people want to feel seen and heard in our songs, and I think we need to approach it with that same kind of urgency and that same sense of wanting to connect and belong within the context of music. So yeah, that's kind of been our journey, and we're sometimes as surprised as anyone that we're still making music, but we don't take it for granted at all.
And I would say that with this new album, with The Center Won't Hold, I mean, yeah, musically the sound is completely different, but your message and your lyrics are still so on course with who you are as a band. I mean, you talked about songs about longing, talking about technology, the daily grind, working through dark times. So while it might sound sonically different, like, it's still you as a band, and I still hear you, and I still appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally this is a band that's always merged the political and the personal. That's a very sort of popular idea right now, but it's one we've been doing for a long time. I mean, a lot of artists, other artists have as well. But, you know, when we were sort of surveying the political landscape, political and cultural landscape, obviously there's a sense of tumultuousness and fractiousness. But we wanted to couch that in more personal narrative and to really speak to how chaos and anger and trauma and despair has an effect on the body, specifically the female body and the female psyche. So I think a lot of this record is an exploration of that.
She stood up for us. She testified. Me, to my body, cried out when she spoke those lines.
What's nice about when you're songwriting is you're only ever songwriting as who you are in the present day. So as you change and grow and age, you know, your perspective on things shifts. And so the stories also reveal themselves in new ways and stretch out in kind of new patterns. So I think it's not uncommon to kind of go back and wrestle with the same ideas, because each time you return to that struggle, you're approaching it differently. And that's kind of the nice thing about longevity is you get to retool things.
Can you talk about the musical inspiration on this album, too? Obviously, you worked with Annie Clark or St. Vincent, who produced this album. So can you talk about how she pushed you musically?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it started with just a change in methodology where Corin was up in Portland and I was down in Los Angeles. And because we were not always writing in the same room, although we did sometimes, we were sending ideas back and forth on our computers and writing as much on synthesizers and keyboards as we were on guitar. So the demos already had a different sonic palette. And then Annie and us talked a lot about the sounds that were kind of corrosive and ugly and kind of creating a paradox where you had some grittier sounds paired with a lot of melody so that you were, you know, those two worlds were kind of existing simultaneously. And, you know, Corin was listening to a lot of Depeche Mode. I was listening to a lot of Ministry and Nine Inch Nails. And I think for Annie, especially Nine Inch Nails, that's a vernacular that she really embraces. And so, yeah, I think we really saw the studio as an instrument in and of itself. So it became, you know, an act of discovery and not just documentation, which was a little new for us. Really, just each song is a planet. Each song was just something that we could completely immerse ourselves in one at a time, and that was something that Annie, aka St. Vincent, really encouraged from us, was just some maximalism and, you know, just a lot of imagination applied to each individual track.
Yeah, it almost has like this dystopian sound.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, I think thematically, you know, we were circling around that sense of, you know, dystopian ideas, and so I think we wanted to match that sonically with things feeling tense and dire. And then again, pairing that with choruses that really were bright, so that it didn't feel like a cynical record. I think cynicism is kind of its own form of toxicity. So we wanted glimmers of hope throughout.
I want to ask you what your take is on the current state of music. And I'm looking at some acts that you've been associated with over your career with Sleater-Kinney. So, okay, we can look at Lizzo, who opened for you last time you all played in Wisconsin. She's experiencing this meteoric rise. Another band you're somewhat associated with, Bikini Kill, they reunited this year. They're killing it. How are you processing musically what's going on right now, and how does Sleater-Kinney fit into that?
I mean, I think I usually process things as a fan. You know, I think we're in a great time for music. You know, it's accessible, it's copious, it is genre bending and very fluid, and I don't know, it just feels like it has a powerful place right now. And certainly there's more like diversity of artists and genres, and that's really great. And I don't know how Sleater-Kinney fits into that landscape. I mean, I guess that's not really for me to determine. I think that's for other people to figure out, but we do what we do, and hopefully people like it.
I have to ask about some of the transitions within the band. Obviously, Janet Weiss left. You've picked up Angie Boylan as a new drummer. Can you talk a little bit about like working with a new drummer? Maybe tell us a little more about Angie. Is that going to change the sound of Sleater-Kinney?
Well, I mean, we've never played these songs live, so I don't think that's going to be. It's not like the songs from the Centerfold have sort of been out in the world live. Yeah, I think for us, it's just, you know, we're just looking forward to the future. I mean, we were, you know, sad that Janet left, and we also feel like we wanted to continue, that we really feel like it's a privilege to play in this band. And I think Angie's a really great drummer. I think it's just about wanting to play the songs, and we played a show in Raleigh, and the response was great. For us, it's just about chemistry on stage and enjoying it. And in the live context, I think it all kind of, all the disparate sounds on each record, you know, the difference between like the Hot Rock and Dig Me Out is massive. The difference between The Woods and All Hands on The Bad One is massive. So there's always been these variations between albums, but it's in the live show that it kind of all comes together under the umbrella of Sleater-Kinney. And for us, it's just important to have a really powerful show and connect with the audience. And Angie's a great drummer. She has a lot of athleticism and great feel. And I think it's a lot of fun.
That was Beta's Maureen McCollum with Kerry Brownstein, one of the founding members of the band Sleater-Kinney. She's talking about their album, The Center Won't Hold. Find out more about Kerry at wpr.org/beta.
The short story works by different rules. That only takes one sitting to read. And a lot of the best short stories end with a final twist of the knife. And I do like that. I do like the ugly jolt of that final twist.
Author Joe Hill joins us to talk about his short story collection, Full Throttle. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Joe Hill is the New York Times bestselling author of The Fireman, Nosferatu, and the comic book series Lock and Key. He also has the same knack as his father, novelist Stephen King, for having his works adapted. AMC has turned Nosferatu into a series, and Lock and Key will be featured on Netflix. Hill's short story collection, Full Throttle, is no exception. Two of the stories were co-written with King, and one, In the Tall Grass, is already a Netflix horror movie. It shouldn't be surprising that Joe has such a cinematic influence. In the introduction to Full Throttle, he talks about one of his favorite films, a 1971 made-for-TV movie called Duel.
I love that movie. It was the breakthrough film for an incandescent young talent. You know, Steven Spielberg was 21 when he made it. He had great source material. Duel was based on a novella by Richard Matheson, who is sort of the grandfather of modern American horror. In some ways, he was Stephen King before there was a Stephen King.
Yeah.
Matheson wrote The Incredible Shrinking Man. He wrote I Am Legend, which has been, I think, filmed three different times. Duel was a novella he wrote in the early 1970s, and it's about an everyman on the run from a faceless truck driver who's persecuting him for unknown reasons. And it was made into a terrific picture.
Operator.
I'd like to report a truck driver that's been endangering my life.
In that case, I'll have to give you the police, sir.
Right, well, give me the police.
Sir, which department do you want?
Whichever's closer.
What number are you calling from?
This number is 9821.
You were only 10 years old the first time you saw Duel. What did you think of it?
I loved it. You know, it inserted itself into my fantasy life. My dad and I would go for drives, and when we were out for drives, we'd pretend the truck was after us. We'd talk it through, you know, about what we'd do and where we'd go, and, the, you know, imagine the truck rearing up to slam the back end of our car. And I did a lot of screaming and stuff, you know, acting my part.
Okay. You want to play games?
So in Full Throttle in the collection, there are two stories in the book. There's 13 stories in all, but I wrote two of them with my dad, and one of them is Throttle. It is a kind of reinvention of Matheson's Duel. That's a story about an outlaw motorcycle gang on the run from a faceless trucker who wants revenge on them for unknown reasons. And in some ways, it was like, you know, it was like we started writing that story when I was 8 years old. You know, we started writing that story playing truck in the car.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the story Throttle that you co-wrote with your father, it's kind of your take on Duel. It seems to me that whereas in Duel, we never learn why the truck driver is trying to destroy Dennis Weaver's character in his car, in your story Throttle, you've included some motivation for the truck driver's homicidal tendencies. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. Ultimately, there is a revelation. There is a reveal. We find out why the trucker is after them. That sort of goes back a little bit to H.P. Lovecraft had this idea that it was important to keep the horror off screen. You know, mm-hmm. that what we didn't see was more scarier than anything the artist could show. And I think there is some truth to that. I mean, like certainly Spielberg in Jaws, his happy discovery in the making of Jaws was that the longer we went without seeing the shark, the more frightened of it we were.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, and this is something I sort of picked up from my dad, I do think at a certain point it's worth risking it, that the reader does deserve some revelation, some understanding of what it was all about, and that maybe the monster does have to come out from under the bed. You do have to shine a light into the back of the closet to see what's hiding there.
Yeah.
So I guess in some ways, that would sort of be one of my dad's disagreements with H.P. Lovecraft's legacy. I'm sure there are others.
I'm curious about how the process of collaborating on this story, Throttle, with your dad worked. Can you tell me a bit about how you two approached that?
Sure, I can tell you what it's like to collaborate with my dad. You ever see any of those Roadrunner cartoons?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So basically, imagine Wile E. Coyote getting a box that says Acme on the side. And then he pulls apart the crate, and inside there's a rocket. And he lights the fuse and climbs on top. And the rocket blasts off after the Roadrunner. And Wile E. Coyote is hanging on top, barely clinging on for dear life. I've written with my dad on two short stories, and both times I felt like Wile E. Coyote hanging onto the rocket.
That's a great analogy. So a book of short stories can't have the same kind of flow that a novel can, but I'm thinking you must have given a lot of thought to the sequencing of the stories in Full Throttle. How did you decide the running order of the stories?
Well, I don't know how much strategy went into it, but you do look for some kind of coherent flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way, it's sort of like trying to put together an LP. You want one song to flow naturally into the next. I know that the first story in the book is Throttle, and that the second story in the book is called Dark Carousel. It's set in the early 1990s, And it's about four teenagers who deface a carousel, a big 19th century carousel, and then there are supernatural consequences. So Throttle was the first time I ever collaborated with my dad, and Dark Carousel is almost like a cover of a Stephen King story. You know, it's like the most Stephen King thing I've ever written.
Let's listen to a bit of Nate Cordry's reading of Dark Carousel.
The Wurlitzer began to play, a theatrical, whimsical, but also curiously dirge-like melody. Wandering amid the steeds, I looked at the creatures of the wheel with a mix of fascination and repulsion. It seemed to me a uniquely disquieting collection of grotesqueries. There was a wolf as big as a bicycle, its sculpted glossy fur a tangled mess of blacks and grays, and its eyes as yellow as my beer. One paw was lifted slightly, and its pad was crimson, as if he had trod in blood. A sea serpent uncoiled itself across the outer edge of the carousel, a scaly rope as thick as a tree trunk. It had a shaggy gold mane and a gaping red mouth lined with black fangs. When I leaned in close, I discovered they were real. A mismatched set of shark's teeth, black with age. I walked through a team of white horses, frozen in the act of lunging, tendons straining in their necks, their mouths open as if to scream in anguish or rage. White horses with white eyes, like classical statuary.
So I wrote Wolverton Station in a notebook while I was on tour for my second novel, Horns, in the United Kingdom. All the travel was done by British Rail. So I wound up taking British trains from London to Edinburgh and back with stops at Liverpool and Glasgow and, you know, here and there around the country. The first day on the train, we flickered through a station and I only half caught the name of it. And I believe the name of the station was Wolverhampton. But, you know, I saw it out of the corner of my eye and I thought it said Wolverton Station. And I thought, boy, what would you meet? Who would you meet if you got off the train in Wolverton Station? And instantly, you know, I mean, I'm a guy who grew up watching films like American Werewolf in London, you know, yes. So I hear Wolverton Station and I immediately imagine a sleepy little British hamlet entirely populated by werewolves.
Mm.
And I thought that was such a fun little idea that I started writing it straight away. And I think I started writing it on my first day on the British trains and finished the story on the last day on the trains just as the tour was winding up. So that was a really happy writing experience.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really happy reading experience, too.
Oh, thank you.
The wolf's snout shriveled, and his black lips wrinkled to show the hooked rows of his teeth. He yawned, and a surprisingly bright red tongue lolled from the opening. And if there had been any doubt in Saunders's mind, there hadn't been really. That was all for it. In the next moment, he fought with himself, a desperate, terrible struggle, not to issue a soft sob of fear. It was like fighting a sneeze. Sometimes you could hold it in, sometimes you couldn't. Saunders held it in.
Are you an American?
Asked the wolf.
Don't answer, don't talk,
Saunders thought, in a voice he didn't recognize. It was the shrill, piping voice of panic. But then he did answer, and his tone was his own, level and certain. He even heard himself laugh. Ha, got me. Excuse, do you mind if I use the bathroom? As he spoke, he half rose to his feet. He and the wolf were in chairs that faced a spotted formica table, and he couldn't quite stand up all the way.
That, of course, was Neil Gaiman reading an excerpt from Wolverton Station. Another story that you wrote with your father is In the Tall Grass, and this one kind of struck me as Lovecraftian cosmic horror, sort of crossed with a bit of a Children of the Corn vibe in terms of setting. Is that what you and your dad were going for there?
I don't know what we were going for exactly. You know, we were both in Florida. He had just finished working on something, and I had just finished working on something. And we went out to the Colonial House of Pancakes, you know, at like 10 in the evening, and we're eating flapjacks or something. And we both agreed we should write a story. And so we came up with something on the spot and wrote the whole thing in about 6-7 days. You know, here we are a few years later, and it's going to be this big Netflix film. I think the drop date is October 4th. And it's really scary, you know. I mean, what a great film. It's directed by Vincenzo Natali. I mean, this is horror for horror fans. It has a feel kind of like, a kind of relentlessly scary feel like Hereditary or It Follows. So it'll be interesting to see what people make of it.
Did Vincenzo consult with you and your dad about what he was planning on doing? Did you guys have any input into it at all?
Very much so. And, you know, he wrote the script himself, and I loved the script. You know, it was like a horror movie version of Inception that takes place in a meadow instead of in someone's head, because it does lots of tricksy things with time and space.
Can you tell us a bit about In the Tall Grass without, of course, revealing any spoilers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, In the Tall Grass is about a brother and sister, two people traveling across country from New England to California, Becky and Cal DeMuth. They're somewhere in the heartland, and they pull over at the side of the road because Becky isn't feeling too well. She's 9 months pregnant. They get out, and there's this giant field at the side of the road. You know, the grass is like 8 feet high. It's up over their heads. And they hear a child screaming in the field.
Help! I'm lost in here!
Did you hear that?
And so they both step into the grass to try to find him. And once they enter the field, they can't find their way out either. You know, they get separated from each other. And at one point, they're shouting to each other. Becky says to Cal, "Let's both jump up at the same time, and I'll see where you are, and I'll head to you." And they both jump up, and they can both see each other. They're about 12 feet apart. And they fall back down. And then Becky says, "Let's do it again. I want to be sure of my bearings." So they jump up, only this time they're 25 feet apart. Neither of them has taken a step, but they are drifting apart in spite of themselves.
Becky?
Travis?
In some ways, the movie is actually a little bit more hopeful. It finds some hopeful notes that are unique to the film. And I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, we all need hope.
Yeah. And not every short story can deliver hope, though. I always feel like with a novel, you know, a novel takes anywhere between 12 and 24 hours to read a whole novel. And I kind of feel like anyone who slogs along that long deserves something at the end, some kind of uplift, some reason to feel like the world is not all terrible. I mean, they stuck with me that long. I want them to have something good at the ending. The short story works by different rules. That only takes one sitting to read. And a lot of the best short stories end with a final twist of the knife. And I do like that. I do like the ugly jolt of that final twist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too. I crave the ugly jolts at the end of the short story. Yes. It kind of seems to me, I want to get your take on this, it seems to me like we're kind of closing in on peak Stephen King movie adaptation right now. We just had It Chapter 2, coming soon is Dr. Sleep, your dad's adaptation of his sequel to The Shining. Why do you think this is happening at this particular moment in time?
Well, first of all, I don't know that my dad has ever really been out of style. Carrie just exploded off the shelves almost from the day of publication. Brian De Palma was filming the picture before the book even came out.
Yeah.
So there's always been terrific enthusiasm for his work. I don't think that's all that hard to understand, because
no,
the books
not.
Themselves
right.
are highly cinematic, and they have these big, fat, juicy, exciting hooks. You know, right now there is a content gold rush. And, I mean, there are so many streaming channels and so many outlets and so much, you know, so many people throwing money around to, you know, buy up any property that they think could make a good film or good TV series, even a web series. I think when the film companies look at my dad, what they see is they look at Marvel. And they look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, Marvel's had 21 hit films, and the films are all interconnected with interconnected characters and themes and ideas in a shared universe. And I think when they look at my dad, they see, you know, all these stories sort of exist in the Stephen King universe, and that shared universe seems coherent and satisfying and like a lot of fun. Scary, but a lot of fun.
So, Joe Hill, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks so much for talking to me, man. I had a lot of fun.
Joe Hill is the author of the short story collection Full Throttle. He and his father, Stephen King, co-wrote the story In the Tall Grass, which is a movie available on Netflix. Learn more about Joe at WPR.org/beta.
He said that in the future, information would be communicated electronically in small snippets of word, text, and sound rearranged.
That he is the beat writer William S. Burroughs. Author Casey Ray tells us how Burroughs predicted the internet and how he served as a muse to many musicians. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. William S. Burroughs was one of the key figures of the Beat Generation. As a heroin addict and a gay man, Burroughs was no stranger to controversy in his life and work. He's best known for his provocative 1959 novel, Naked Lunch. The book has served as an influence to so many creative acts over the years, so it's not surprising that he is the muse to many rock legends, including Patti Smith, David Bowie, and Kurt Cobain.
The ancient Egyptians postulated seven souls. Top soul, and the first to leave at the moment of death, is Ren, the secret name. This corresponds to my director. He directs the film of your life from conception to death. The secret name is the title of your film. When you die, that's where Ren came in.
Author Casey Ray explores this influence in his book, William S. Burroughs and the Cult of Rock and Roll.
Well, when I was doing the survey of William S. Burroughs' influence on the sort of constellation of musicians who pop up in my book, I realized that Burroughs kind of meant something different to each of them. And I think in terms of pure inspiration, different artists took different aspects of his work, lifestyle, or worldview with them in their own creative journey. For example, somebody like Lou Reed would be drawing from earlier Burroughs books like Junkie, which at the time was kind of unusual matter-of-fact reporting on the truly seedy underbelly of the 1940s and 50s and narcotics addiction.
I'm waiting for my man. 26 dollars in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Feel sick and dirty.
And Lou Reed, you know, would channel that sort of repertorial prose in his own efforts with the Velvet Underground and beyond. Somebody like David Bowie, on the other hand, might draw from Burroughs's creative methods.
Uh-huh.
So it really depends on who you are and where you are and what you are inspired by.
So would you say that Burroughs kind of served as a Rorschach ink plot in terms of like the different people? Would it be fair to say that in terms of the way different musicians saw different things in him?
And you know, the interesting thing about that is Burroughs's literary executor and longtime literary assistant for the sort of latter portion of his life, James Grauerholtz, told me that Burroughs was very prismic. He straight up said that you know, a lot of folks saw something of themselves reflected in his persona for whatever reason. Even though Burroughs as a person was remarkably consistent in his manner and character. He was a very, by all accounts, accommodating and gracious person if you knew him personally. Not necessarily the most open person or easiest person to know, but I think a combination of his work and also sort of the renegade outlaw status that he'd earned as early as the 1960s, when I think some of the musicians in the book start gravitating towards him. His ability to capture these artists' imagination and to continue to capture their imaginations, you know, has persisted over the decades.
Yeah. How do you reconcile Burroughs' misogyny?
His misogyny, I think, sometimes was a little bit of an exaggeration, a stance, a put-on. He had very close relationships with women, actually, and some of them continue to go to bat for him. The poet Anne Waldman, for example, is a prime Burroughs champion. And in my book, of course, Patti Smith takes up almost an entire chapter because her relationship with William S. Burroughs was incredibly close, very genuine, and lasted right up until the end of his life.
She even had sort of dreams of fantasy of she wouldn't mind marrying.
Yeah. You know, William Burroughs. Patty's funny. She will come right out and say that she's an unabashed hero worshiper, and Burroughs is in her personal pantheon of heroes. She said he's right up with the Pope.
Yeah,
I think Patti Smith identified with Burroughs in a lot of different ways. And interestingly, even though Burroughs was not actually particularly moved by rock music or rock musicians or the trappings of fame and celebrity, he understood the medium's shamanic potency. And Patti Smith, he saw as being an amazing, incredible vessel for that. And he was at her earliest readings at St. Mark's in New York, and I think just kind of understood what she was trying to get across.
His father died. He left him a little farm in New England. All the long black funeral cars left the scene, and the boys just standing there alone, looking at the shiny red tractor. Him and his daddy used to sit inside and circle the blue fields and grease the night.
And I think she was really moved by his kindness, his genuine sort of concern for his small circle of friends, as well as his artistic fearlessness, I think. And these are folks who kind of invented themselves. All of the musicians that appear in this book have that in common. There's a point where they kind of are in chrysalis and then emerge as something that we would recognize as a great artist. And interestingly, Burroughs seems to show up at all of the key junctures in these artists' creative development. He was there in a basement flat provided to him by Paul McCartney when Paul McCartney wrote Eleanor Rigby. Paul set him up there to do tape and audio experiments. Burroughs was cutting up and rearranging tape. And, you know, some of those ideas surely made it onto Beatles records.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have Bob Dylan, who practically hunted him down and begged Allen Ginsberg for an introduction to Burroughs at a time when Dylan was chafing at the Voice of a Generation kind of, you know, folk hero cloister that he found himself in the East Village. And lo and behold, after his meeting with Burroughs around 1965, he commits the ultimate heresy of going electric at the Newport Folk Festival. So you see this sort of seeding happening over and over again with key artists.
Let's talk a bit about Kurt Cobain, how Burroughs influenced him.
Well, Cobain discovered Burroughs as a teenager, which is kind of how I related to Burroughs as well. Cobain was absolutely obsessed with Burroughs to the extent that he tried to get Burroughs to appear in the video for Heart-Shaped Box, which was a song from In Utero, Nirvana's final studio album. She has me like a Pisces when I am weak. I've been locked inside. Burroughs turned down the offer because in the treatment, Cobain had him being crucified, and Burroughs didn't want to be seen dying on camera. He was a very sort of superstitious thinker. He had a fundamentally occult worldview, and he believed that the media arts were in part a way that, you know, those energies were realized. So he said, no, I don't want to do that. Although they did develop something of a relationship too. Cobain visited him in Kansas towards the end of Burroughs' life. And I was lucky to have some really great firsthand sourcing on that from Nirvana's road manager, who was Alex McLeod, who was also very close with Kurt personally. And it was a way to sort of understand what actually happened that day, but also to understand how Burroughs might have seen Kurt. And the impression that I got was that Burroughs recognized something in Kurt Cobain, something, you know, profoundly hurt and traumatized. I think a lot of people did, but also saw that he had, you know, a lot of artistic potential. Uh-huh. And he took Kurt's road manager aside and said, your friend hasn't learned his limitations, and he needs to learn them soon. But yeah, he remained in this old man's thoughts. And even after Kurt passed, Burroughs supposedly poured through the lyrics to In Utero looking for a reason or some sort of explanation why this person would take their own life. Because even after everything that Burroughs had been through in his own life, he just couldn't understand what would motivate somebody to end it.
Yeah, you mentioned the collaboration. Let's get back to that collaboration that Cobain and Burroughs did. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, again, Cobain was bristling at superstardom. The explosive success of Nevermind and, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, he put them at the top of the pop, so to speak. And I think he really wanted to recapture something of that avant-garde, underground punk rock essence, and Burroughs for him was the distillation of all of that, the sort of the fount.
Fight tuberculosis, folks. Christmas Eve, an old junkie selling Christmas seals on North Park Street. The priest, they called him. Fight tuberculosis, folks.
They collaborated at a distance. I think that Cobain laid down some tracks, and then Burroughs put some spoken word onto it. But it was commercially released, and you know, it's not the kind of thing that was meant to light up the charts. And I think Kurt wanted it that way. It's really just squalls of guitar feedback and Burroughs's creaky Midwestern voice intoning over it. It has a soporific effect that's also entrancing. And I think that that's part of what musicians really relate to with Burroughs in general. It's not just his written word, but his published books and essays and interviews. He also recorded a lot, you know. He's been sampled a ton, and he has this way of talking that really makes people want to listen more for some reason. And,
yeah,
you know,
it's just this
strange cadaverous cadence.
Yeah, that's well said. A big part of William Burroughs' legacy is his cut-up technique, which was actually invented by his friend, my fellow Canadian, Brian Gysin. Can you tell us how Gysin discovered the cut-up technique?
Yeah, Gysin was apparently preparing some canvases and had accidentally cut through some pre-existing text. I think there might have been a newspaper underneath. And it just so happened that they were cut into four quadrants that he then rearranged and realized that, you know, there was almost like this hidden text that emerged, you know, a psychic palimpsest or something. And so he was wowed by that, and he told Burroughs about it, and they started experimenting using that particular technique, cutting into any pre-written text into, four quadrants and then rearranging it. Sometimes Burroughs, would reshape that further, and I think a lot of the musicians who borrowed this technique would use it as a get-out-of-jail-free card, so to speak. You know, you get in a creative log jam or have writer's block, and the cut-ups will suddenly reveal something new. Other artists like David Bowie or Genesis P. Orridge from the industrial bands Throbbing Gristle and Psychic TV were also interested in the more occult aspects, that it could reveal something about reality or your own creative sensibility in the moment. Bowie called the cut-ups a kind of Western tarot, and I think that that's a way that, you know, Burroughs himself probably would have related.
Yeah, and Bowie was a big believer in the cut-up technique. He used it to write a lot of his lyrics. Why?
Bowie was always interested in finding new perspectives and new ways to sort of reveal something about... I think sometimes he used it as a dodge, right? Bowie was always changing masks. But the cut-ups are a really interesting way to bootstrap your whatever creative process you're in. It's just the idea, essentially, of injecting randomness, a random factor, into something. And it's surprisingly durable as a technique.
I'm an alligator. Coming for you. I'm the space invader. I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you. Keep your mouth shut. Just squawking like a big monkey bird. And I'm busting up my brains for the world.
And I think that, you know, it's not that Burroughs necessarily invented this, but Burroughs was the first person to really advance this method in the, I think, the part of the 20th century where new technologies could make it applicable to other media.
Yeah.
And when you extrapolate, you can see that the internet itself is a cut-up, this universe that we live in of mashups and memes and so on and so forth would have been very, very interesting to Burroughs. In fact, he said that in the future, information would be communicated electronically in small snippets of word, text, and sound rearranged. And I do believe he was interested in how they could be weaponized because, you know, he had this fundamental view that the universe was a hostile place.
And Burroughs not only created these regular, what I guess we could call visual cut-ups, he also created sonic cut-ups. Can you tell me about those? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that that is a really interesting thing when we get back to the Beatles, right? Being present at birth for, you know, some of those world-changing Beatles recordings that, you know, I'm not going to say that Burroughs was the sole influence on something like Sgt. Pepper or Revolver or whatever. You know, they were also interested in Stockhausen and the 20th century neoclassical composers. Who were deeply experimental and using the studio and electronics to sort of break down barriers in composition. But Burroughs had put out a record, a spoken word record, that was like really just absolutely cherished on the hip London underground of 1966, right? Uh-huh. And so this is what all the cool hash smokers would be listening to, Paul McCartney among them. So, you know, they became hip to Burroughs while Burroughs was living in London. And as it turned out, Burroughs was actually in a relationship with a young computer engineer who had become an audio engineer for the Beatles, a young man named Ian Somerville. And Burroughs was... He had difficult, I think, romantic relationships throughout his life, but he was head over heels for Ian Somerville, who was working for the Beatles. So he got introduced to Paul McCartney, who set him up in Ringo Starr's flat that he wasn't using, and set up a recording studio down there with Ian Somerville. So this is where you get the first impression of Burroughs actually doing tape cut-ups. Which, of course, provides the basis for what we now know of as sampling. And when you get to later generations of musicians, like I mentioned Genesis P. Orridge from Throbbing Gristle, who invented an entire new genre of music called industrial that essentially uses Burroughs's cut-up methods and occult worldview to sort of fashion a new broadside against control coming out of the punk generation and taking us right up into the present. Hip-hop artists have also embraced Burroughs. It's fascinating to think of this relic of the jazz age, this white guy from the Midwest being an MC, but you know, you'll hear Burroughs on all kinds of underground hip-hop records. There was one record by the Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopercy that made really effective use of Burroughs.
People often ask me if I have any words of advice for young people. Words of advice for young people. Well, here are a few simple admonitions for young and old. Never interfere in a boy and girl fight.
So his influence is subliminal and profound.
Mm-hmm. Is there one thing that you can point to as being William Burroughs' single greatest contribution to rock and roll?
You know, I think the book Naked Lunch kind of launched a thousand weirdo ships, right? Like, that book was really kind of a permission slip to radicalism in whatever kind of creative medium. It is a book, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a record album. But I think that was the one that sort of changed things. And you find a lot of different folks. I mean, we're talking like... Jerry Garcia and Trent Reznor are very different people, right? but I think that like all of them would have had some recognition of Naked Lunch as being a game-changing work.
How do you think rock and roll would be different if William Burroughs had never had this kind of vast influence on the genre?
Well, I posit that none of this stuff would exist, like so mm-hmm. much of what we take for granted. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about like bands that I was into when I was like 16 years old, like Led Zeppelin. And then you find out that Jimmy Page had an interest in William S. Burroughs's occult worldview, for example. Sometimes it's hard to pin down, and other times it's like it's pretty obvious. With somebody like Patti Smith, you can say, wow, she was actually really motivated to develop her talents as a poet because of her personal relationship with William S. Burroughs, and also the influence that she drew from his work. With somebody like David Bowie, I mean, David Bowie drew influence from a lot of different places, but he would not shut up about Burroughs until, you know, until the end, right? And this is a guy who didn't often reveal his hand. So I think that that's, it really underscores how significant Burroughs was to his own creative development and outlook. And so when you extrapolate for that, right, like how many people has Bowie influenced? And then you get to the modern era and you find folks like Radiohead and you do a little digging and you realize that, oh yeah, they used cut-ups too, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if everybody sleeps with a copy of Naked Lunch under their pillow, but I do think that the influence is atomized to such an extent that that Burroughs gene is carried across all of these different genres that grew out of rock music in the 20th century.
Casey Ray is the author of William S. Burroughs and the Cult of Rock and Roll. You can find out more about Casey and William at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Carrie Brownstein, Joe Hill, and Casey Ray. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to Maureen McCollum.
You're such a super lady.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Come on, Steve. We've got D in the carpet.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You know what, Adam? You're not a victim of this game. You're part of it.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Douglas, get off the juice.